Hello and welcome to another episode of The Joint Venture. Two hosts covering two sectors, infrastructure and renewable energy. I'm John McNair.
And I'm Martina Canela-Copullo.
And welcome everyone to another episode. Very glad to have you joining me again, Martina. As you may be able to hear, I've got a pretty heavy cold at the moment. Thought I'd just confront that right at the top of the episode. You know, despite face masks and all that, still managed to catch this. I'm blaming one junior member of my household for bringing it home, but they will remain nameless. How are you doing, Martina? You well?
I'm good. I'm relatively better than you. I am trying to protect myself from a spring cold, to be honest. Last weekend, for example, in London, it was pretty much summer. So there there was a risk there. Because you can easily forget that when the sun goes down, it's classic London winter again. So I'm trying to protect myself. I hope you feel better soon. You already sound better than the couple past days, so that's good.
Yeah, yeah, I think I'm on the mend. And, you know, we obviously, I think since we last published an episode, we've had the major reopening plan for certainly this country onto summer with a number of steps. The government said they didn't want to release something, a plan full of dates that they will inevitably miss, and they achieved that by releasing a plan full of dates, which hopefully they won't miss. But so, you know, we're looking at June sometime for back to normality. They say.
The idea is that all the UK adult population will be vaccinated by end of June, which is what indicates that, okay, July onwards, there may be freedom. We may go back to a fair amount of normality. So, I don't know, to me it was great news. It gave me strength to, you know, be patient, be more patient right now, and to just go through winter and just wait for the spring and live a proper summer this year. As inspiration, we got excited as well, but we will announce more on that later. But I can just reveal that maybe I will be able to use my physical business cards soon.
What a teaser that is, Martina. We'll say no more. Watch this space for that one. Well, we also might even be able to record one of these podcasts in person in future, which would be a very novel thing. I mean, for anyone listening who doesn't know, we record online in much the same way many of you do your meetings on Zoom or Teams or whatever, and, you know, we may even be able to interview a guest in person too, who knows. That'd be nice, but you know, we'll stay disciplined until we're allowed to.
Yeah,
well, shall we get on with today's business then? In this episode, we're joined by Chris Beaufay, who's a CEO at a company called Sharper Shape. Now, this company works with transmission and distribution utilities with their inspection regimes, bringing smart solutions for those companies to help manage their assets. And as you'll hear in the interview, this is a topic that has been brought into sharper focus due to climate change, particularly in places like California, where Chris is based, where there has, of course, been an intensification of wildfires in recent years. And that can naturally lead to consequences not only for the local population, of course, but for infrastructure owners due to the damage they can cause. But also, the fires can sometimes be caused by faulty power lines igniting the tinderbox conditions in forests or scrublands around the state. So stay tuned to hear from Chris with more on that later, and we delved into a number of other topics. But that's coming up in a few moments. And first, we will head into this week's news. And maybe I'll kick off this time. And this week was, of course, budget week in the UK, and Chancellor Rishi Sunak laid out his tax and spending priorities for the next period. Of course, this was a budget heavily focused on coronavirus and I guess recovery from the damage the pandemic has wrought. Interestingly, there was no real big mention of Brexit, which is another huge issue, obviously causing major impacts across certain parts of the UK. This was also a budget which was anticipated to have a pretty decent infrastructure and clean energy tinge to it. The headlines from our perspective are a new national infrastructure bank is to be set up in Leeds. This was not a surprise, as had been widely trailed in the run-up to Sunak's speech, as had most of the plans, in fact. During Prime Minister's questions directly preceding the budget, Boris Johnson made a comment about listeners and MPs finding out more in Rishi Sunak's budget following PMQs. And the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, in the House of Commons, actually made the comment saying, well, I've heard most of it already anyway, which is true. I mean, that's what they do these days. They didn't used to. It was used to be convention that nothing at all was revealed, but they focus group everything and leak things and see how they fly. Anyway, that's by the by. The new part of this announcement about the National Infrastructure Bank was its Leeds location. Kind of makes sense, really. The government have long said, you know, they want to spread their functions across the country. There were announcements about Treasury offices going into Darlington, I think, as well, in the north. You know, north being a key focus for the government. Leeds also has more or less the strongest financial services sector in the north of England. So makes a lot of sense to put the bank there. The bank itself will be initially capitalised with £12 billion, although Sunak claims the bank will support more than £40 billion worth of investment in infrastructure, particularly of the clean or green variety. The government also claims it's the first ever state-owned green infrastructure bank. Those listening to this will probably know that that's political spin, really. The government, of course, used to have the Green Investment Bank, which it sold to Macquarie a few years ago and was rebadged as Green Investment Group. And it hasn't gone unnoticed that this was also a key idea to set up a national infrastructure bank in the 2019 Labour Party manifesto. So the Tories have, to put it politely, taken inspiration from that, it seems. Perhaps there will also be free broadband for everyone as well coming on the horizon. But the bank itself, the National Infrastructure Bank, will have a broad sectoral focus. Clean energy, transport, digital, water and waste are all areas that have been eyed up for investment. The bank will be able to provide not only debt, but also equity and hybrid structures, as well as guarantees. And it will be able to offer debt to local authorities at a price of gilt plus 60 basis points, which is pretty cheap, to be honest, even in a environment of extremely cheap debt, as we've been through for the last few years. There was some other stuff tucked away in the budget, or rather published separately and not really made a big deal of by Rishi Sunak yesterday, and that was a plan for growth, as the government is calling it, and that seemingly sweeps aside the government's industrial strategy, which was published in 2017 in favour of new plans. There's lots in that, and you can go away and read it if you are so inclined. But the key points for us were new details on timelines for some hotly anticipated government initiatives. It says in the next 3 months there will be a heat and building strategy, an industrial decarbonisation strategy, amongst other items. The next 6 months will bring the highly anticipated hydrogen strategy, and I believe that represents a slight delay on initial expectations. There will also be a transport decarbonisation plan published in the same time frame. Then in the next 12 months, we'll be getting a digital strategy and a net zero strategy, which for the latter one is some time to wait, I guess, and I think a delay on previous assumptions too. However, the rough timescale does just about give them time to put this out to coincide with COP26. So that might be the plan there. And I think that would be sound like a good time to publish a net zero strategy. Some other final items, and I promise this is final because I know I've been going on for a while, from the budget is a green recovery bond for clean projects. There will be reform of the Bank of England's mandate to include a target for net zero emissions, and that's on top of the existing Bank of England target for a 2% inflation level. And finally, there was an announcement of free ports. Again, this was something that we had seen coming. These would be special economic zones with different rules to make it easier and cheaper to do business, and they'll be launched. They will include infrastructure planning, customs, and of course, favourable duties and taxes. And there'll be a number of those sprinkled around the country. And that's about it from me for the budget. So what did you have this week, Maritina?
My story is fairly different from your story, but I may be able to travel your mind to more exotic locations. And the reason I'm saying that, it is promising, I can guarantee that. The reason I'm saying that is because the story that particularly drew my attention this week is the first tangible project announcement, project pipeline around offshore wind in Greece. The story is around EDP Renewables and ENGIE through their joint venture Ocean Winds, a 50-50 joint venture that was established about a year ago to tap into the offshore wind and floating offshore wind opportunities globally. So Ocean Winds collaborated with local energy conglomerate Terna Energy to develop 1.5 gigawatts of floating offshore wind in the country. So let's take things from the beginning. First of all, EDP Renewables and ENGIE formed a highly strategic collaboration. I'm not surprised that Terna Energy is the first Greek developer and investor to tap into the up-and-coming sector. Basically, Terna is one of the largest renewables players in Greece. Just to put this in perspective, the company currently holds 700 megawatts of installed capacity of solar and wind, and Greece's overall capacity as of beginning of 2020 was roughly 6 gigawatts. So basically, Terna Energy holds around 12% of the country's installed capacity. That's not bad, is it? And of course, there is a big pipeline from themselves as well. Ocean Winds is a well-established joint venture. It has pretty ambitious plans to have a total of up to 17 gigawatts of offshore wind and floating offshore wind in several phases of development, including operational, under construction and pipeline by 2025. The joint venture has already announced plans for US, Europe, Asia. US was actually very recently, because they actually launched Ocean Winds US, a new entity to tap into the US market. So this may be a tiny amount for some, but for Greece it's pretty significant, 1.5 gigawatts of offshore wind, floating offshore wind, will be deployed over the next decade. Why this story got me excited is because offshore wind right now is very much happening in Greece, but everybody's working really hard to set up a plan for how to tap this opportunity. According to 2030 energy targets, the country is aiming for 19 gigawatts. So if you consider that today the country has 6 gigawatts, basically Greece is aiming to triple the capacity in a decade. This is pretty ambitious, and this is why everyone is very excited about offshore wind, because offshore wind will play a role in terms of scale, especially given the geophysical landscape of the country, which is pretty mountainous. Also, it's a small country and doesn't allow for large-scale projects like either solar or onshore wind, like the sizes you see in Spain, for example. This could never happen. So if there's a chance for scale, it's basically offshore wind. There is intense consultation around the offshore wind prospects in Greece, The discussion has started intensely since a few months ago. So right now, basically all different shareholders, grid operators, the regulatory authority, the private sector are on fire to come up with a robust institutional and regulatory plan. It's a very exciting time for the country and one that Greece has been waiting for quite some years. I've personally been hearing it about for quite some time because when one thinks of Greece, they think of these endless coastal zones and the good wind resources, famous from Aeolus, the keeper of winds in Greek mythology. Just to give you some updates of where different shareholders are working on, we know for a fact that the Ministry of Environment is working on a spatial planning. The study is under development and it is expected to be completed by 2022. And as you can all understand, spatial planning is an important prerequisite before anyone kickstarts any development activity. The regulatory authority has two studies ongoing right now on environmental impact reports and to narrow down offshore wind potential in different locations of the country. It is expected that this will be ready by 2021. AVMIE, the grid operator, is currently evaluating costs of new transmissions, which of course will be required and will play a big role to actually estimate project costs. Some challenges that I can share from some personal experience is that Greeks are very protective of their coastal zones because a large amount is actually used for recreation and tourism. So it doesn't really come as a surprise that the first announcement is actually about floating offshore wind, which will actually give the opportunity to go a bit deeper and possibly minimize objections from local communities. I've read about some market chatter for possible auctions, offshore wind auctions next year. It, to me, it seems like an extremely tight timeline. Maybe I end up being wrong, but given the amount of preparations needed and the level of readiness, right now, I don't think that auctions would be possible within 12 months. There's a big emphasis in reading any framework, tapping into this new opportunity in an extremely environmentally safe way. So that was my story. I don't know, John, if I managed to make your mind travel a bit to an exotic Greek island maybe.
Oh yeah, I mean, you're talking about Greek coastal zones and the recreation. yeah, I had a few these circumstances, a few immoral thoughts. I think they weren't that moral. It was just sunbathing. But it's interesting to see and hear about the offshore wind market spreading into other countries. Obviously, you know, Europe has led the way with offshore wind in many regards, North Sea in particular, but now we're seeing projects spread along the Baltic coast eastwards, and then now, as you say, you know, around in Mediterranean, and I think you know, Italy, there's big plans there too, the south coast of France as well. We've seen some plans emerge, so you know, for a continent that's bordered on three sides by seas, it makes a bit of sense, I think. Particularly, you know, a continent that is, heavily populated, and perhaps the best place to develop some renewables is offshore.
If locals do not object. I think this is a common challenge across Mediterranean countries. And it was very interesting for me, this particular announcement from EDP Renewables and Engie, because it seems like a target to me. I don't think that there are any particular developments. It's just that they chose to establish themselves very early in the market, purely strategic. So maybe we'll hear more of these announcements now coming up. Even as they said, this will be deployed over a decade. So it's very early on, and I don't think it's random given how much intense discussion is going on right now in Greece. And maybe we will see some bold and ambitious players announcing more details on other Mediterranean countries, as you said, and to see how this plays out in the region.
Yeah, and you know, maybe we'll get people involved on the podcast in future. Why not? I think it's time to move on to our interview for today. And as I mentioned earlier, today we're talking to Chris Beaufay, who's CEO of Sharper Shape, and which offers intelligent asset management solutions for primarily electrical utilities. We spoke about the company's history and plans, wildfires in California, climate change, many other topics in a really nice conversation. Have a listen. Well, hi, Chris. Thank you very much for coming on the Joint Venture Podcast today. As a start off, would you like to give us an overview of some of the history of Sharper Shape and also what your company is setting out to achieve?
Yes, and thank you, John. Thank you, Martina. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. A little bit on Sharper Shape. We have been a company since 2013. Our roots go back to before that. We were doing some research with the Finnish Geospatial Research Institute, and then became a company looking at and working with the Finnish utilities to look at utility right-of-ways as they look at building new structures, new spans in the utility sector. They have to go through and make sure, of course, that they clear out vegetation and do things the right way. So that's actually where we got our start. Broadly, that's a space that many would just call vegetation management. We have since expanded that, and we moved. We still have a very large presence in Helsinki, Finland. We moved from Finland into the United States, and in the 2017 period, we're very much engaged with helping utilities in California work through inspecting the infrastructure, doing both vegetation management and asset intelligence, understanding what their assets were. What that means is we collect LiDAR data, we collect RGB, visual imagery. We also do something called hyperspectral imaging to collect information on the utility assets and the vegetation around those assets. And then we can take that data and put that data into operating systems that they might use. We also have our own operating system that can help the utilities do their inspections, understand their asset base, dispatch their technicians into the field. So that's a little bit of how we work. And so we've, you know, been around since 2013, and we've been growing rapidly, particularly the last 3 years, really starting in California, but we're also, in terms of that growth, we're also now very active in multiple countries and states outside California in the U.S.
Thanks for the introduction, Chris. Many interesting aspects there to talk about. We will have plenty of opportunities to speak about all these dedicated segments. However, I would like to start with a fairly challenging question, just to stick to our butter and bread here at Inspiratia, the financing side of things, before we move into an extensive discussion about your company offering and the services and your clients and all these interesting things we want to talk about. So I see that Sharper Shape has been has had a few venture funding rounds. So I know that you're very new in your role, but I'm sure you have a good knowledge of the history of the company and how this has evolved, how investors have been looking at Sharper Shape 6 years ago and how they are now.
Yes. So we have had a an interesting, I think, history as a company in that we had a founder. His name is Taro Heinonen. He's still an investor in the business, but no longer involved with the business. So he sort of bootstrapped the company back in the 2013 period. In 2016, we did, maybe most people would probably call it a seed or a pre-Series A round. And that was done in Finland. And so our shareholder base is Finnish VCs, Finnish high net worth individuals, and friends and family. And so that's the only round that we've done, single digit millions round. Since then, we've been really cash flow positive, working from customer contracts. And so that has had, of course, its pluses and minuses. I think on the positive side, being a startup of our relatively young age and being cash flow positive is a great place to be. On the negative side, as we try to go and expand into many more geographies and bring our offering to many other customers, that's going to require further growth investment. And so this year, in the first half, we'll be going out for a financing round, really focused on taking the products that we've had and moving them into more geographies, more customers to really capitalize on the market opportunity and the growth ahead.
So that's really interesting to hear about your plans there. I mean, do you have a kind of expected kickoff time for that, or has it already begun? And is there a sort of rough amount you'd be seeking?
We're in the early stages of that. One of the things that we'll be discussing with the potential investors is exactly how we want to go about tackling the market. So as an example, I think we're in a unique place because being cash flow positive from customer contracts means that we really can scale that investment to the opportunity that we want to pursue. And so in reality, we could do tens of millions of a capital raise. We could do more than that because I think the industry is significantly underserved by the participants in the industry. It's highly fragmented. And as you know from our earlier conversation, I do have, of course, some mergers and acquisitions background as well. And so I think there's a lot of things in this space that give some flexibility with the right investors to look at what would be the most strategic play and the amount of capital. For us to achieve organic growth of going from tens of millions of revenue to, you know, 100 million or more of revenue is in the tens of millions of dollars range. But I think there's a lot more opportunity in the space than just that.
Okay. And in your answer to my first question a few moments ago, you started to tell us a bit about, you know, the services you offer and how they've evolved. I mean, I just wondered if you could dig into that a little bit more and perhaps, you know, tell us if there's newer technologies that are being incorporated into the services you offer now and what can they provide for your clients?
Absolutely. So I think one of the items that a lot of outsiders would look at us as without really understanding the solution we provide is they notice the fact that we fly drones. They may notice that we have a sensor pod that goes on helicopters. And that's just I call it the starting part of our business. This is we have to work well with utilities. Sometimes with them, sometimes we do the work to go out and capture the data in the first place. So whether it's using a sensor package to get LiDAR data, visual imaging data, different wavelengths of image capture, we'll call it, to get that information into the system in the first place. And so we tend to talk about being, quote, platform agnostic, meaning that we can use our tools to collect the data. We can use customer tools to collect the data. And by tools, I'm talking about sensor packages. And those sensor packages can be flown on helicopters, fixed wing drones, and even in some cases use satellite data. And so that's one part of our business. The next part then is once we have all that data, there's a processing phase to that data being able to take that data and put it into usable forms, whether it's used as an example in a GIS system, or whether it is adapted to go into what our system is, which is called Core. And our Core operating system allows customers to both visualize their assets in 2D and 3D. It also allows them to do maintenance dispatch. It also allows for insights in terms of vegetation management. Has there been a violation of a boundary, as an example, where there could be a higher risk of fire, as an example, or in snow-like conditions, a tree getting too heavy and falling on a line, as an example. And so in our system, we can provide exactly those insights to them. And then the last bit that factors into the whole ecosystem is we've generated and created a number of applications, one for the helicopter pilot, one for a drone pilot, one for a data collector operator, and one for the what they call the linemen who are going out and maintaining these assets so that we can do a much more efficient operation for a utility. So I know that's a lot, so I'll welcome any questions, but that's effectively what we do. We cover that whole spectrum of what the utility needs.
So your core clients are utilities, from what I understand. What are the main drivers that make utilities want to make their assets smarter?
There's a couple things. What has really driven the need in, as an example, California, what really changed things significantly was the significant fires that occurred back in 2016-17 time period. There's any time, as an example, there are more than, there's between 7 and 8 million miles of utility lines throughout the United States, whether it's on the transmission side or the distribution side. And predominantly, just think transmission gets it from one long place to another long place, long distances, whereas distribution is how it gets from those stations to our home, those substations to our home. And so there's a huge asset installed base. That asset installed base goes across many areas where there are trees and different types of vegetation that could be a fire risk, as an example. And so in order to capture that, that's a first step. Understand and baseline what is what the utility's assets, where they're represented. One of the things we have to think about is we've had some of these utility assets have an average age, most of them well in excess of 25 years. So when these were built and put in place, the tools that we have today just didn't exist. So there's a part of baselining all that. The second thing is when you really start to look at the advancement of the transmission and distribution networks globally, as many more countries have embraced renewable energy, as an example, we have to go in and improve that infrastructure. As we look at improving that infrastructure, that's another opportunity to look at what do we need to do to be able to get the generated energy from those renewable energy assets to where it would be used in businesses and homes, as an example. And sometimes that means looking at and understanding the existing asset base, but also what do we need to build to support that renewable energy generation, as an example. And there are many examples where understanding that base allows for much more effective operation across the entire system. And so we really help in that, and that's a big driver in that. In a lot of ways, customers would look to us and others like us for as part of their risk mitigation plans and as part of their growth plans.
Yeah. And a moment ago, you described how for your clients, you could offer sort of 2D and 3D mapping of their assets. And, that sounds, hopefully it's fair to say, like a sort of digital twin approach. I don't know if that's the terminology you use, but it's something we come across yes. A lot here. I'm just interested to understand from you, how much of that is going on in the, let's say, the utility industry. I mean, is that widely adopted now, or is there still, a lot of untapped kind of potential there?
The answer is both, there is a tremendous amount of untapped potential there. We do use the same terminology, digital twins. That usually starts with the LiDAR collect, and then from the LiDAR, we'll take those point clouds and we'll effectively, either in our system or in other systems, turn those into digital assets to represent that 3D digital twin. And then, of course, once you have that baseline, you can see how it changes over time, and you can see whether it's vegetation or other objects around there, how they change over time as well. And so that is exactly part of what we do. There are specific regulations in the U.S. around predominantly transmission. And so a lot of that type of work has been done for years for the transmission side of the transmission and distribution network. Distribution is more local, and so it's been more highly varied in what has been done in that area. And I think this is where being us coming to California, and California probably being one of the leading states and therefore also countries, and really looking at the total picture, transmission and distribution, to capture these assets and do these digital twins. But that's exactly the space we play.
You've mentioned that the value that you add is mainly on the basis of risk mitigation tools. So why don't you tell us a bit more about some specific ways that climate change and extreme weather is actually affecting the utility industry, and what are the main risks out there for now?
Yes. So we have really started to talk a lot about the wildfire season. I think the past 3 years, we all thought perhaps they were, you know, once in a decade, once in a century type fires and climate effect. That, of course, has not turned out to be the case. And I think, unfortunately, what we may be looking at is the new normal, which is that wildfire season is particularly on the west coast of the United States, but not just the United States, Australia, Southeast Asia, and Northeast Europe. There's been a significant amount of fires that are created both naturally and in some cases also unfortunately created by a tree coming in contact with the utility asset. And so that is a trend that unfortunately is likely to continue with the climate change that we're seeing, with the large amounts of call it fuel that exists around these, that unfortunately due to droughts and many other conditions are creating that fuel. So that's not going away. The other piece that has really factored into this is the inspection routines may or may not be enough to be able to fully mitigate that risk. And that's where tools like we have are able to help step in and really help the utilities better do that risk mitigation. A couple just, you know, quick unfortunate statistics is in California alone, there's unfortunately been more than 100 deaths due to utility-related fires. There's been more than $22 billion of cost directly related to utility-started fires. Obviously, you know, it's the utility assets and the vegetation interaction that creates the fires, obviously not the utilities themselves. And so these are real-world challenges that we need to find better ways to address, and that's what we're trying to help both our customers but also our communities address.
I know that usually we need to follow the precautionary principle, but unfortunately we need a kind of wake-up call to make us more aware. Do you think that over the past 2 years, utilities are more aware of these risks, and not only the natural disaster cost, but actually the cost on the utility itself?
I do. I think it is most acute here in California. I think there's been a very high level of sensitivity to that, not just through the regulatory means, but also, unfortunately, through litigation and others. It has had a real cost to the utilities. I think other states have started to see and feel those pressures. The wildfire season this year was not just a California phenomenon. It California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Texas, all of these states had to deal with significant wildfire exposure this year. And some of those states, there's also been quite a bit of regulatory and legal pressure on the utilities. So that has a real cost. The second piece that we look at is we always have to weigh the cost of prevention, right? These businesses are in the purpose of being, you know, sustainable ongoing assets, so they have to look at total cost. And in that situation, when we look at the cost of inspection versus the benefit, depending on which analysis you look at, typically a dollar spent in prevention, the types of things that we do, yields between $5 and $7 worth of overall savings to a utility, whether it's on their wildfire mitigation plans or in their operations.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, you described, you know, sadly, there's been an awful lot of deaths that could be attributable to, you know, utility assets in California. But then you've got, you know, the some mitigation methods like, you know, shutting down power supply along a vulnerable line. And both of these things to different degrees, obviously one very serious, one perhaps more trifling, can erode, obviously, consumer confidence in these kind of businesses. I guess the question is, you know, what you're doing, is it kind of charting a line through the middle of that and trying to find the best way to obviously, you know, prevent serious danger and peril, but also to in some ways, you know, kind of improve the operations and therefore the standing of these companies amongst consumers for less serious shutoffs and things like that.
Yes, the interesting challenge, I think, for utilities in particular, the public safety power shutoffs are a reality of the world we live in with climate change and everything else that we just talked about. But the size and scale of the PSPS, public safety power shutoff, can be adjusted based on risk models inside of the utilities. And so if we can help the utilities better understand their risk profile, they can minimize the size and scale of the PSPS to just that necessary to prevent further damage in the case of the fire. Because ultimately, when you have a fire, right, you want to have the power off initially, but as soon as you've got the fire under control, you want to actually restore it as soon as possible for the first responders. And so being able to have a clear understanding of the assets, to understand that risk model, to minimize the size of the PSPS, and then restore power as soon as possible to help in the recovery. All of those things are parts of that we can help affect and help reduce the consequences of those situations. I think PSPS, I know it can be very frustrating for consumers, myself included. I've been subject to them. But if we can minimize them to the size necessary, I think that, you know, we can find the right balance.
Maybe we can continue on a more positive note to reflect on some overall challenges faced by utilities nowadays. You did mention that in your offering in the beginning that one of the main challenges is for grid operators and utilities managing the assets is the decentralization, the decarbonization of the grid. So would you like to talk to us about this side of the business?
Yes, I think there's a very interesting sort of convergence of things that are happening now, right? When you look at the new administration in the United States as an example. And one thing I want to be careful of, we are definitely a global company. The majority of our technical resources actually sit in Helsinki in Finland. And we have done quite a bit of business in other countries as well. It's just currently the revenue driver for us has been the United States. And so within the United States and the new administration, a significant focus in reinvesting in the power infrastructure in the United States is critical. There's been numerous studies done, one by the American Society of Civil Engineers, as an example, back in 2017, that actually went out and asked power generation and utility companies just how well they know their assets. On a sort of a A to F type scale, like when we're all in school, they rated it as a D plus. And so there's a real need out there to go out and understand and really get a good baseline of where we are. And then from that, we can do the right types of investments to really build a grid that is more sustainable. The other piece that we have to really think about with the recent announcements on really electrifying transportation. I think it was General Motors that just announced that, you know, they will not produce fossil fuel vehicles 15 years from now. So you think about the total amount of investment that that's going to take in the grid and all of the new things that are going to have to be looked at in terms of right-of-ways, of creating those new infrastructures, how robust the existing system is. The other thing that is often written about is that the infrastructure today is probably 25% in need of serious repair. And so when you start to look at those types of numbers, participating in that, starting with that data capture, that digital twin, and looking at how that changes is going to be a critical trend going forward. And hopefully you can hear it in my voice. We're very excited to play in that because I think ultimately it's a real need. And I think in particular, in a lot of countries, they're recognizing that need and they're starting to invest.
Yeah, perhaps, picking up on the last point, first, before we look at perhaps the changing nature of generation itself, but firstly, greater electrification. You mentioned specifically through transport, but also I guess there's other demand sources for electrification that will really take hold over the next few years. You obviously mentioned it that with that comes a need for increased investment from companies like utilities. And you kind of started to describe, how that would drive them to companies like you. I mean, would all the businesses be, do they see that picture now, how it will be smart to actually go and do the preventative things and save the money? Or will there be more, are there some that are kind of more kind of snowed under by just the sheer weight of investment that they feel they need to make over the next sort of decade or two?
I think I'm trying to think of a good way to say it. It's sort of a mixed bag at the moment. I think you see every viewpoint because the number of utilities is in the number of thousands, right? And each of them thinks a little bit differently. And other than needing to meet some of the federal regulations, many of them are operated quite locally. And so the innovation and thought of the leadership within the utilities drives a lot of what they decide to do. And as I mentioned before, in California, we've seen through necessity a significant change in how this is being viewed. But there's quite a few countries we've seen a lot in South America, as an example, that are really looking at what they need to do. They've also had issues with wildfires. Australia is doing a lot around these areas. So I think necessity is driving a mind shift change. What's happening, I think, too, is because we're using newer technologies, and once you get beyond the initial data collect, the ability to operate more effectively is starting to be seen by other utilities. And so, like many other inflection points that happen in an industry, the cost profile of operating utility, I think, is going to come down over time with the improved intelligence. And so I think people are starting to see that and wake up to that. And it's not just in the inspection side of the business. I think by and large, bringing AI-like technologies and algorithms to the way that our utilities operate, which will also be critical when we bring more and more renewables onto the grid, is a major trend. I think investors are seeing that. I think some strategic participants in the energy space are seeing that. What I would call is, quote, smart money is in it now. And I think broadly that's becoming more known and others are starting to wake up to that fact.
You've mentioned several examples of markets outside the US. I mean, the company itself is headquartered in Helsinki. So I'm just curious to see how come, why do you think the main cash flows come from the US? And as a follow-up question, from our discussion so far, I can see that there's a tremendous potential in the country. So, from some initial thoughts, are you looking at dedicating most of your resources in the US and tap this market, or will you continue to look at other markets, a bit more shy maybe, depending on the resources of the company? I'm asking from a business perspective.
Yes, from a business perspective, we're absolutely looking both inside the US and outside the US. It's a question of readiness, predominantly of the utilities that we're working with. As you can imagine, as the number of countries you're operating in, the infrastructure that you have to have to support that changes significantly. And so in a lot of ways, what we're really doing is in new countries that we're going into, whether they're in Europe, whether they're in South America and North America outside the US, we are in many cases working with a local country partner to help us, particularly around the aerial data collects, i.e. helicopter groups, drone groups, et cetera, so that once we can get the data, then we can apply a lot of the tools, whether it be digital twins and data processing and our core operating platform. So our model's a little bit different outside the US. And then also as we're moving into some other states, a number of utilities have invested in their own data collection groups. And so we're working with them to do a similar model like we're doing outside the US. So by and large, we're trying to work smartly and capital efficiently into going into countries. But in a lot of cases, we have to have a strong pool from utilities, and we also are looking for strong partners in those countries.
Yeah, perhaps before we close, we're talking about, you know, the future, I guess. Before we do that, just a question kind of became apparent to me is that when you're collecting all this data from lots of various different clients and various different countries, presumably that throws up some issues around, you know, cybersecurity, quite substantial issues, particularly when you're talking about, you know, how they're linked to physical assets. We've seen, you know, in the last few years, I think, very high profile case of Norsk Hydro in Scandinavia, which had a kind of denial of service attack, I believe it's called. Different area from where you are, I guess. But how much of that does kind of fills your thinking time, but also that of your clients?
This is a significant item that we focus on daily. We have architected our entire system to be cloud-based. So that's partially because of how we developed, right? We have a very, you know, good presence in the United States, also in Finland, and we operate globally. We are architected on an AWS backbone, so Amazon Web Services, and we're hosting a tremendous amount of data, over 5 petabytes worth of data that we've collected and analyzed for our customers. And because the utilities, for all the right reasons, are risk adverse, we go through cybersecurity audits, IT audits, and the fact that we are architected on an AWS backbone really does help in that situation. We are able to apply the security tools of, quote, the big guys in a battle that is real. And leverage that security of their architecture. And then we supplement that, of course, with our own security audits, third-party advisors to make sure that we can address those issues. But unfortunately, like climate change, that's not an issue that's going to go away, and so we just have to stay ahead of it.
As we're approaching the end of our podcast for today, I would like to close with some outlook. So we've talked about overall drivers and overall trends. In the near-term future, what are the micro trends you expect within the utility sector?
The micro trends, I think, are in many cases not quite micro, but I do think the recent wildfire season is both a macro and a micro. The local communities have become quite active in understanding the risk associated with the areas within they live, and of course the utilities are a big part of that. So that's a micro trend that is definitely continuing. We see that in California, we see that in Oregon. I think that will also probably expand into Washington State. The other trends that we're seeing is as communication has picked up, strangely enough, COVID, I think, has driven a interesting dynamic in that we see utilities communicating more, probably because they don't have to go to a conference to communicate. They can get on a Zoom call or a web conference. And so there's a lot more exchange happening between. And I would say three of our most recent opportunities to bid have actually come from recommendations from utilities that we've worked with as they've communicated the types of tools that are available. And so I think as this knowledge is spreading around how these tools can be helpful to reduce operating costs, that's a real trend, a micro trend that we're seeing that hopefully will continue and help us build.
Thanks very much to Chris there. It was a great insight into an area not too many of us think about all that much, I think, but perhaps we should. And that's about it from us today. Please feel free to check out all of our episodes wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Twitter, search for The Joint Venture, you'll find us. Say hello to us on there. Also, you can get in touch by emailing podcasts@inspiration.com. And on all of these platforms, a like, a follow, a subscribe would always be greatly appreciated. All that's left for me now, though, is to say thank you to my co-host, Maritina.
Thank you, John.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. Look forward to seeing you again next time.